Session number 10798, Reel 1.
Mr. Bradshaw, Reel 1. When did you first join the Navy, please?
17th of November 1937.
Why did you join up?
Well, I was working in coal mines from the age of 14. And by the age of 17, coal mines were on 2-3 days a week. I'd walked around the country. I used to walk to Nottingham from where I lived in Bilsthorpe, in Nottinghamshire, in those days, about 18 mile, to rallies, Selenese, players, looking for another job because we were only working 2 days. And after a night shift, I walked to Nottingham looking for a job one time, and I saw this recruiting office, the Navy. I thought, oh, well, I think I'll try that. I'm fed up with nothing to do. And with that, I joined the Navy. Eventually, this must have been in the summer of 1937, I eventually got to Chatham in 17th of November 1937.
Was it easy to get into the Navy? Was it easy to
get
into the
No,
Navy?
Because when I... There were six of us lads from the coal mines looking for other jobs, and when we went to join up in the Navy, the six of us, I was the only one that got in. One was colourblind, flat feet, all sorts of peculiar. And the funny thing was that I thought I would be the one who wouldn't be allowed, because prior to going to join the Navy, I was working in the coal mine, and I had my little finger end chopped off, and it was still red raw. But they never noticed that until I went for the medical. We went to Derby for the medical. And this doctor, you know, bend down and do all these other peculiar things that doctors did. And then he was doing this put your hands out and stretch your fingers business. And, of course, this was red raw, giving me hell. And he said, what happened there? I said, oh, I'd work in the coal mine and it fell on the end. One of these pit tubs fell on the end, weighed a ton, and knocked the end of them. Oh, it'll heal up. And I was in the Navy. These other five didn't get in.
Where did you have your basic training?
In Chatham.
What was it like?
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was out in the open air and, you know, we did the normal squad drill and things like this. And, of course, as telegraphists, we had to learn Morse up to 22 words a minute and transmit Morse. We had to be able to decipher codes and ciphers. A certain amount of technical knowledge, because in those days, of course, radio operators were technicians as well. But I enjoyed it.
Was there any part of the training that you didn't like?
Not really. I probably didn't like getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning on a frosty, snowy morning, having to scrub the covered way down out of snow in bare feet and things like that. But I mean, these young lads of 17, you know, I don't know if it's a challenge or discomfort, but you're trying to carry on longer than your mate sort of idea. But I never remember anything from basic training that I didn't like. I don't remember anything from the Navy that I didn't like. It taught me to cook. It taught me to do all sorts of things. And it did, in fact, give me an excellent occupation in civil life.
How old were you when you joined up?
17. 17 and a half.
What was your date of birth?
1st of February, 1920.
Which was the Bedouin the first ship that you joined?
Oh, no. During training in those days, we used to go on board... I went on board the Erebus for gunnery training, you know, heavy gun training. It didn't convey very much to me at the time. I wasn't really very interested in them. And I also went on a vessel called HMS Wanderer for what they call sea training. We only did a week on these things, really. But eventually, when all the training was finished, some of the class, 12 of us in the class altogether, some went to HMS Southampton. A friend of mine, Albert Speed, his father was War Graves Commissioner in Belgium, this lad. he went to Punjabi. And I went to HMS Bedouin. Of course, she was brand new, commissioned, brand new, beautiful ship.
What work were you doing as telegraphist on the Bedouin? What does it involve?
Well, my first duties on the Bedouin, I found that as an ordinary telegraphist, a very ordinary telegraphist, in fact, there was three of us there, our first job seemed to be scrubbing out the cabin, the wireless cabin. We had a first office, which is a big office, about as big as this room, about 12 or something like that. And a second office was a small room, probably a third as big as this. And then we also had one on the bridge for direction finding. Now, that one on the bridge, when the war started, was where I first had an introduction into what was known as the Y survey. We used to go up there, we were given frequencies and given information about what U-boats would do and possible frequencies coming up. And we had to swing this gonio round, if we heard them, and get a bearing.
Swing what round? Swing what round?
The aerial, gonio. It was a gonio aerial, you know, one of these Marconi gonios, directional. And the idea was to get a DF bearing on the submarine. I never actually heard any. I didn't know what it was all about to start with. But, of course, after scrubbing out, we were under instructions as well in those days. The chief always ensured that in the morning, you know, we'd scrub the office out and then we would have to start flogging up for the exam for your next grade, from an ordinary telegraphist to a telegraphist to a trained operator and to a leading telegraphist and petty officer onwards, you know, like that. So we're always under instruction by him. And eventually, of course, we were put on routine stuff, listening to Morse. And then the first job that I really remember as a telegraphist, where I was really on my own, was away from the routine, just writing routine, but on what they call the fleet wave with the destroyers on there and working between the destroyers. And I was terrified. They work so fast, you know. But eventually I got onto it. It was all right. All part of pre-war training, really.
You were saying the Bedouin was brand new. Was it a comfortable ship to live and work on?
Oh, she was absolutely marvellous, really, for pre-war boats. There were 16 Tribal-class destroyers, and the Bedouin was part of the second Tribal-class. And, of course, they were absolutely modern for that period. As I say, when I did sea training, I went on board HMS Wanderer. Now, she was a 1914-18 boat, but we were only there for a few days for sea training. But this was luxury, P&O sort of idea, you know. Absolute luxury and beautiful and clean and smart and everything else. It was a beautiful ship.
How were you accommodated on it?
Well, we had hammocks, of course. We were on the first deck down on the communications mess deck. Watchkeepers were all down there, people who kept watches, because normal crew were working during the day, or peacetime, they were. But there was a mess deck, just watchkeepers. This was people who were permanently on watches, you know, working during the night, and quartermasters and people like that. And on this deck, hammocks and about 15 of us to the deck. Signalman telegraphers up to leading rates, because the POs had their own mess deck, things like that. Canteen messing, what they call canteen messing we had, which meant that we were allowed 1 shilling and threepence per day per man. And from this 1 shilling and threepence, we had to buy from the canteen food to which we prepared ourselves. We peeled our potatoes, prepared the meat if it was a joint, and things ready for dinner. All out of 1 shilling and threepence per day.
Was that enough?
Oh, yes, because if you had a very good caterer, and we had a very good caterer called leading telegraphist W.N. Bradshaw. He came from Chatham. I often thought I was put on there because I thought he was my elder brother. But there was no relation whatsoever. But he was our caterer, and he was extremely good. because he was also a very good cook, so that tea time he would make a parking cake and something like this for tea, you know, for tea time, cup of tea and that. Whereas in the other messes, they'd probably say, oh, well, they hadn't got a very good cook. They'd open a big tin of fruit or something like this. But of course, that was very expensive. And at the end of the month, when all the bills were paid and everything, the caterer of the mess would say, all right, we're so much in debt, so it costs you all another shilling or whatever. But more often than not, we used to have 2 shillings back. We'd fed very well. We also had 2 shillings each. But some of the other messes that used to eat very well with custard and cream and fruit were in debt for 2 shillings a month. It was 2 shillings of the day's pay, though, then.
At this time, did you expect war to break out?
Well, yes, because, as I say, the Bedouin commissioned late 1938. By 1939, we'd been down to Chatham and things like this. And in June 1938, we were doing an exercise in the Home Fleet. And we were about to do this exercise, and it was an exercise to cover the whole of the Atlantic Ocean and sort of locate every vessel at sea and report them what they were and produce these navy certs that they were all right and all that. Part of a pre-war exercise, really. But June the 3rd, of course, I was in a pub in Weymouth when the patrol came in. And I think this was the day the war started, for me anyway, June the 3rd, because the patrol came in. He says to me, what vessel? I said, Bedouin. He says, 6th Flotilla, which was the tribals with the 6th Flotilla. Back on board, you wanted, all of you. So I came out of this pub, and I went to another pub called the Black Dog in Weymouth. My mate and I, we shot into this pub, by the way. And we sat at the bar there. And the patrol came in with our hats were in the corner out the way. See, we're in uniform. And the patrol came in and says, what flotilla? 4th, which was the Foxhound and all these F-boat things. Right. And this barmaid behind the bar, she says, I know you two. You're from the tribals. And the tribals are the 6th flotilla. And you've got to go back on board. We're stopping out. We're having a night out. She says, well, the thetus has gone down, and that's why you're wanted back. Of course, that was it. Back to the ship. Now, of course, we went up to Liverpool Bay and see this submarine 18 foot in the air, and sat and watched it till Captain Oram came out. Signalman Shaw, Stoker Arnold, they popped out. Captain Oram, he came on board the Bedouin, and I was on watch at the time, and he made us tell to the chief, here you are, send this signal, and he gave it to me to send, and it was to the Adelphi Hotel in Liverpool, to his wife, pack our things, we're going back to London. And I often thought, what a callous sod he was. The submarine just gone down, off he was going home. But from then on, we went to Scapa Flow, did the exercise. And I think from then the war had started for us because we were at sea then all the time.
So what was the Bedouin supposed to do with the attempted rescue of the Thetis?
Well, all the destroyers in Weymouth, the 6th Flotilla, were sent to rescue the Thetis to assist in her recovery. In point of fact, when we arrived there, there was a little bit of nonsense going on between Camel Laird's and the Admiralty that the boat hadn't been taken over and it was still under Camel Laird's, and Camel Laird's said, you know, it's under Navy and all sorts. We sat there and watched the damn thing go down eventually. You know, she just slowly, after the 3 survivors came out, she just sank slowly down and that was the end of it. With that, you know, we left shortly afterwards and went to Scapa Flow. And that was the Thetis finish. She later, of course, refloated and called the Thunderbolt, and she was lost during the war, of course.
What were you doing when you heard that we were at war with Germany?
Oh, I was on the mess deck, and we'd had breakfast and cleaned the mess up. We'd been to Sunday divisions. We'd had prayers on the quarter deck, and we'd come back waiting for top time. But we knew that this broadcast was coming on at 11 o'clock. And, of course, we sat there in silence listening to this thing. And eventually, Chamberlain, of course, announced, that's from 11 o'clock, this country's at war. And there was a cheer went up. And sadly, there were very few left to cheer after the war.
Why do you think they cheered?
Well, I think it was this humdrum sort of state of limbo. The war was coming. What do we do? We're neither one thing nor the other. And I think more or less it was a cheer of relief, really. I don't think it was anything different. Because the next cheer I heard, it brings to mind another cheer I heard, was after the Battle of Narvik, when HMS Eskimo, one of our other ships, had been hit by a torpedo going into Rombach Fjord. And as she backed out, we gave her a cheer. Unfortunately, we also passed HMS Cossack, who during the action had gone full speed ahead up on the rocks and took no further part in the action. And we booed like hell at her. Anyway, she didn't belong to Chatham Depot, was another excuse. But we had a very curt signal back from the Cossack to say that, to the captain sort of business, to say that the attitude of your ship's company was not very good, insofar he had 14 or 15 killed and all sort of things.
Was the booing partly because it had gone aground?
Well, we're booing because they're all the competition in the Navy between Chatham, Portsmouth and Devonport. It was a friendly rivalry, and, the fact that they booed the Cossack, I don't think it really meant very much. It was just an expression of sympathy, really, for the Eskimo.
Going back to the beginning of the war, what kind of duties was Bedouin put on?
Oh, we had a terrible time, really. In September, when the war started, of course, within 2 hours of the announcement, by 12, 1 o'clock, we'd up anchored and we were out of Scapa Flow. And we proceeded then to Northern Patrol. And, of course, we spent the winter on Northern Patrol on the Denmark Straits between Iceland and Greenland, waiting for the Germans to break through there. And, of course, these 1,870-ton vessels up in the Denmark Straits with a roaring hooligan of a gale blowing all the time. It wasn't very comfortable. But we spent the whole of the winter up there. In fact, we came back. I remember coming back into Greenock around about 22nd or 23rd of December 1939, coming back for more supplies as much as anything, because we'd been supplied at sea, but we came in just to give a couple of days leave and back again. But I always remember we went up to Glasgow and it was Sunday. We couldn't get a drink or anything. Everything was closed, because everybody was looking for a pint of beer. And anyway, we wandered around Glasgow for a couple of hours and then went back to Greenock. We spent the night enjoying ourselves with a cup of tea and a cake in what was known as the Girls' Club, and then went back on board.
The Girls' Club?
Yeah, I never figured out what this Girls' Club... It was for girls in Greenock, around about 18 to 20. It was a girls' club. But during the war, they sort of opened the doors to sailors or servicemen of any sort, I believe, and supplied cakes and tea, teetotalers, because we were a teetotaler. It was Sunday. Well, they called it the Girls' Club. It made you welcome, things like that. There's at least somewhere to go and sit down. That was the main thing.
Now, coming on to Norway, was this the first time that you were in action?
Oh, no. Before Norway, we were in action down the Kattegat when the submarine Spearfish, when she was down there, and she was depth charged and in trouble. And when she eventually surfaced, she then started to come back up the Kattegat. We were detailed then, four tribal class destroyers, and either the Southampton, the Sheffield, there were two cruisers. I forget whether I could find them from books somewhere, I suppose. But there was four destroyers and two cruisers. And we went down there with the idea that we would pick the Spearfish up and escort her back. But our first lieutenant, Lieutenant Commander Peter Agnew, later Sir Peter Agnew, still alive, his birthday on the 8th of July, his 90 next birthday, he came down on the mastic. He said, I'm going to put you in the picture of what's happening. We're going down to rescue the Spearfish, who's been badly depth charged and she's in trouble. And the idea is that the Germans will sight us and they will send in their capital ships into the Kattegat and bottle us in there. But the home fleet, the Ark Royal and King George the Fifth and everybody else, as soon as the German fleet starts to come down there, then the home fleet will come and this will be a big contribution to finishing the war. But of course, they tried it in the First World War, and the Germans were no fools. They sent about 500 bombers over. So when we eventually clued up at the top of the Kattegat with the home fleet, I remember standing on deck there. We had this submarine in the middle of all these boats, and In the screen as well was the battleships and the Ark Royal. And, of course, these bombers come all loads of them, hundreds of them. They came over wave after wave. They're all going for the Ark Royal. And, of course, I was stood on deck as I am now, you know, with just a blue jersey on, watching these. And all these bombs, I always remember these bombs coming down, hundreds of them all together. And they all seemed to drop on the Ark Royal, or as happened, round the Ark Royal. And of course, as they went off, this water went up in the air, 100 foot or something like that. And then through this great wall of water, I always remember the Ark Royal come blasting through. Well, what happened then? I think they must have taken a photograph of the Ark Royal as she hit all this water and disappeared in it. But we saw her come out at the other side, of course. But they must have taken the photograph at that moment. So, of course, the first thing was Lord Haw-Haw and the German radio announced the loss of the Ark Royal. So the Navy said, right, let them think so. And Ark Royal went speeding off at the maximum speed down to Cape Verde, out the way, and let them think she'd gone. But there was no casualties. Nobody got hit out of all these bombs.
Did you see the Spearfish? Did you see the Spearfish?
Oh, yeah, she was with us. We picked her up, escorted her up, you know, plodding, doing about 5 or 6 knots on the surf because she couldn't go down when she was there. And, she went back to Rosyth, refitted. In fact, I think she finished the war.
Did you ever speak to any of the crew?
Not to the Spearfish, no. No, because after that had finished, you know, once the Spearfish had gone on its way, the home fleet, some went to Rosyth, we were all detailed different places. The Ark Royal, she tore off on her own with a couple of boats and went down to Cape Verde. We went to Scapa, refueled, and, of course, back onto Northern Patrol.
What's other action did you see before Narvik?
Well, we took the bullion boats across to Canada, but there was no action on that. We're just patrolling round. We had quite a lot of bombing at sea, you know, and you're on patrol, you know, you get these German, what do you call these big German boats used to come. They come and drop a few bombs at you, but they couldn't hit you. It's too little, smaller target, really. Major action, I can't think of any after that. Other than, as I say, it was Northern Patrol. I remember getting a signal one night of an emergency signal coming through on Fleet Wave, I was taking these things down, this groups down, and at the end of the message, this fellow goes, da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da, BT, BT, this sort of thing. And he made Deutschland. Anyway, I passed this signal to the skipper, and it was actually a pocket battleship that just nobbled the Royal Pindy. But of course, we were not involved in that. Just one of the things that happened of reading that particular signal.
What does fleet wave mean? Fleet wave.
Fleet wave is what the fleet were normally communicating on, because you had destroyer waves.
The wavelength.
The frequency allocated was for the fleet in general. Another frequency allocated to destroyers. In battle, there's a frequency allocated for spotting aircraft, which, of course, I was on in the Battle of Narvik, actually. I was on that frequency. And when I remember in the Battle of Narvik, while I was on this frequency, I was sat there and this spotting aircraft from the war spy, it was a walrus of some sort, he made a signal. It was a torpedo-bearing Pennant's F-67. And I give a big blink and that's me. And threw this signal out. It was a torpedo bearing on the Bedouin, see? And of course, he shattered it out, and of course, we avoided it. But that was during the battle.
Can we go on to the Norway campaign now? And can you take me through the campaign as far as it affected you personally, in as much detail as you can recollect?
Well, from the start of the Norwegian campaign, which of course started with the First Battle of Narvik on the 9th of April, night of the 9th and the 10th, actually, which was when Warburton Lee and that crowd went in, we were patrolling at the end of the fjord, you know, to see that nobody came in and nobody got out. And, of course, after the first action, we then... I think we went down to a place called Bodø. We have then collected all the other boats together. And on the 13th, by the 13th, having got the boats together, we then proceeded up Rombach's Fjord with the boats in line ahead. There's photographs somewhere of this. And you probably got it in the museum anyway. The boats going up to Norway and up to Narvik with the war spite at the back. I have seen pictures of a war spite at the front, but she was way back, actually. And, in fact, the leading destroyer was ourself, Bedouin, and Cossack were the two leading boats, so the others, you know, like a fantail out. Of course, prior to the action, I'd been on watch on the 13th. I think this was Saturday, Sunday, wasn't it? But, anyway, I'd been on watch from 4 o'clock in the morning, and came off at 8 o'clock, and